get started here. So there's a few faces here I don't know. My name's Rob, and I'm with the LaRouche Youth Movement. And we're starting to, we've taken on a project to build up our presence in Ottawa. And one of the things we're going to do is keep holding meetings every 2 or 3 weeks, hopefully every 2 weeks, here or potentially at other locations around the city, because of the times that we're in and the absolute necessity of getting a shift in policy. And I think that's why all of you are here today, because you recognize that things in the world as they are currently going cannot much longer continue. So I wanted to present a few ideas on the current time that we're in, but leave lots of time for discussion. There are many things going on that we could talk about. What I wanted to begin with is tragedy. Now, there's a few. We got a few examples of this just from the last couple of days, because you know we have a few signs that are less than pleasant if you're a fan of Al Gore. And you get this funny response from people when you bring up global warming or other issues of the environment. A number of people, Assad had a conversation like this, I think I did, JP had, I think, at least one. I think all of us pretty much experienced this. You'd be speaking to someone who would seem totally reasonable. You know, you're discussing the global situation, yeah, Cheney, Bush, get rid of those assholes, yeah, this kind of thing, right? No problem. Then you say, well, now, there's this issue, though, of Al Gore and this fraud of global warming. And immediately, whoa, take your literature, I'm out of here. I can't believe you just said that. Now, and they just leave. They freak out and they leave. That's kind of strange. You know, so what's actually going on here? Because why is it, to question global warming, is this become more of a religious issue than an issue of science? And can we not question the so-called authorities, question the consensus that apparently exists, but only in the minds of people like David Suzuki and others in their fantasies? Well, I mean, personally, they know full well that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of dissenting scientists around the world. But these guys know that they're committing a fraud. So they use this, the power of popular opinion, to try to, in a sense, intimidate the population into going along with something without questioning it. In a certain sense, you can see how global warming, a certain element of it is self-guilt. And Canadians love this, right? We like feeling bad about everything. But in a sense, that's there, right? It's me. I'm the enemy. I'm my own worst enemy. I'm destroying my own environment, this kind of thing. And it's repeated and it's repeated. And, you know, they show Al Gore's movie, and they'll be showing it in kindergarten soon, probably, right? Start the brainwashing young. You know, you create the no-fact zone, right? It's just slogans and so forth, and guilt tripping, instead of actually having a legitimate discussion on scientific principles, known implications of changes in our solar orbit, and so forth. You know, that we're not always the same distance from the sun. You know, the seasons are not always falling at the same place on the orbit itself. You know, you have all kinds of the sun itself. I mean, have you noticed what happens when the sun goes behind a cloud? And yet people have completely discounted all of these questions when they come to their conclusions on global warming. But there's another aspect to it as well, because here they are, all caught up on this issue. And you look at what's happening in the world, right? You see, we've got this famine that's now hitting, in a great part because of this the environmental lunacy of the last 30 to 40 years, which says we don't produce anymore. Production's bad, industry's bad, agriculture's bad, CO2 is bad. Well, plants love it, but... And they're so fixated on this one thing that they can't see, as they say, you can't see the forest for the trees. They can't see this greater issue that humanity itself has been brought to a point of existential crisis by the folly which the society, the population itself has adopted. And this is a central point for Mr. LaRouche's economics and also his approach to organizing the population. I mean, if we want, people want, later we can discuss more in terms of global warming itself, but we can leave that for the question, you know, discussion period. But this is a question of dynamics. One of LaRouche's discoveries was that society itself is governed by ideas. You know, as he expressed recently in a paper, that human beings are concept-driven, not event-driven. That this is a big difference between human beings and animals, for instance. Right, that human society is shaped by ideas. Now, some of these ideas are more apparent, you could say. You know, it's what people tend to discuss on the streets or popular opinion and so forth. But on a deeper level, you have philosophical issues, philosophical ideas, which are not conscious for most people. This is why in all of LaRouche's writings, at some point, he returns to the nature of man. Is the human being a beast or not? And what are the implications for the organization of society, which are embedded in that that difference? Now, on a related question, now think, when I talk about dynamics, take a few examples from geometry. Now, if you have a straight line, okay, just a... Unfortunately, we don't have a whiteboard or something to draw on, but if you can imagine just a straight line. Now, what is the shortest distance between any two points? It's a straight line, right? And it's a one-dimensional... You can go forwards or backwards, you could say, along that line. Now, if you then substitute the line for a surface, like a table here, right? Now you have an additional, you could say, dimension of movement, where you can move, say, forwards and backwards, and then left to right also. Now, the shortest, if you say, what's the shortest distance between any two points on this, on a flat surface? What you'll also conclude is that it's a straight line, you know, between two points. Now, pardon me. What if you take a sphere? What's the shortest distance between any two points on a sphere? Right. It's not a straight line anymore. Well, not from the standpoint of the tabletop, but it's what's known as a great circle. That is a circle, which the diameter of which, the radius of which is, you know, the radius of the sphere, because there are many different sized circles that you can trace out on a sphere. But you're talking about the largest one. And if you take any two points, there will be one great circle, which intersects both those two points. Now you can look at you can take any surface. And what you find is that what's called the least action pathway, or the path of shortest distance, will have a different characteristic for every different surface that you are confronted with. I mean, you can imagine a pumpkin, for example, or a donut. Now, the point of this is that when you think of these different surfaces, think about different societies, different forms of economy. Like looking back at a hunter-gatherer form of economy compared to a nuclear-based economy like we have today or could have more fully, right? And look at the productivity of your population or the standard of living, these different forms of measurement. And you'll start to understand what we mean by dynamics, that now in the case of the line, the surface, like the flat plane and the circle, you're looking at different constructions in different dimensions, right? One is one-dimensional, one is two-dimensional, one is three-dimensional. Now, an economy is kind of like that too, because with every discovery we make, it's like adding dimensions of action, if that makes sense. Like increasing our freedom of action, increasing our powers of production, as LaRouche expresses it, our ability to support more human beings per square kilometer, right? Which is what really allows us to have 6.5 to 7 billion people on the planet today, as opposed to a few million maybe back in the Stone Age or before that. Now, what happens to a society if you start to remove those principles which we have in the form of technologies? Right? This capacity to support life will begin to collapse. And this is really what we're facing now, whether it's with the famine or, as you've probably noticed here in Ottawa, increasing numbers of homeless people. We've seen it in Montreal. Right. So the belief within the society that we don't need progress is actually dooming the society. You can't find a way to just use solar power. You can't find a way to just manage with wind. That's not going to work. But people, you know, they think, well, that's, I have the right to that opinion. But in a way, there's no going back. And this is just one of the conditions of our existing in the universe, whether we like it or not. We can say, we can deny it. We can say, okay, screw progress. And the universe is going to say, okay. But you're going to have to live with the consequences of that. So it's important to look at the folly of a population, not just the folly of the leadership. Like a perfect example is how, you know, people are, I'm sure you've all wondered, how is it that the Americans voted for George Bush a second time? The first time, okay. The second time, come on, guys. Right? This is dynamics. Shakespeare understood this in his great tragedies. Like in Julius Caesar, you don't see the tyrant in the first scene. You see the degenerate Roman mob. Right? Our leadership today on Parliament Hill is only a reflection of the population, of the problems that which are embedded in the population's accepted way of behaving, accepted opinions, and so forth. I mean, and, you know, we were... Well, in Montreal, you know, Montreal was in the press a few days ago, wasn't it? If you saw the newspapers, we lit things up after the hockey game, right? Yeah, these mobs of people, they burned 5 cop cars, or they torched, 15 or 16 cars in total, I think. You know, mobs in the streets and this kind of thing. All going wild because the Canadians won a stupid hockey game. Right? What's going on in these people's minds? You know, we notice that on the streets. We talk, hey man, look, we got to stop a famine. We got a collapse of the banking system going on. And they say, look, I understand what you're saying, but the only question on my mind right now is who's going to win the hockey game tonight. That's my world. Totally wild. You know, a bunch of guys chasing a piece of rubber around for millions of dollars. I mean, who really cares? Not very bright, the hockey players? Or not very bright to follow this stuff? Yeah. Yeah, it isn't. You know,
when you think of people like a neurosurgeon who has had about 15 years of training,
mm-hmm.
he wouldn't make as much in a year as some of these demons that are pushing the piece of rubber around on the ice.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It is. You know, it reminds me of the most decadent periods of the Roman Empire, when you know you could read stories about these idiotic mobs who would get into these massive brawls over their favorite actor, you know, competing actors even, you know, or the gladiators or a chariot driver or whatever. You know, it's very reminiscent of that. You know, and that should provide us some insight into how we address the society. Right. What how do you, because you got to change these people. But how do you change them? Right? Because we could go out there and try to beat them over the head, but I think we all try that at a certain point as organizers, when you go out there and say, God, these people, nobody wants to stop today. You know, nobody, because you see the crowds pass by, you know, and they'll pass by.
If you try to be too headstrong with any hockey fans, they might start fighting.
Yeah, they might. But you know they're in the zone, so they can't focus on too much else.
No
so.
Penalty boxes.
You know, so these are very important considerations. This question of tragedy. You know that populations or great nations like the United States do not destroy themselves because somebody from the outside comes in and conquers them. That may happen, but that's only the final act of a process which begins. Long before that. Right? It's that the ideas, the culture itself, self-destructs and leads to the weakness, leads to the moral and economic degeneration of the society. And, you know, if you read, a few of you have read this pamphlet, Averting Doom, that's one thing that Mr. LaRouche focuses on very much in all of his speeches. Go back to the day that Franklin Roosevelt died if you want to understand what has happened to the United States today. How the U.S. was turned away from its mission, the mission that Roosevelt had laid out for the nation, which was a revival of what had happened previously in the United States under, you know, great leaders like Lincoln and so forth, and the leaders of the American Revolution. Now, another element to this, so you keep the people in mind, is the empire itself to be considered, right? Because the tragedy of the empire is somewhat different than the population. You know, the population, it's kind of like the comic book view of history, right, or of what's going on in the world. You know, very simplistic, very naive, you know, very much based on sense perceptions and so forth. But now, the empire, they also are doomed by their own axioms, you could say, or their own self-evident beliefs.
Which empire are you referring to?
Well, we call it the British Empire, but it's not simply British. What we're really talking about is a globally extended oligarchy. You got families. It's mostly, you could say, within the transatlantic community. But it involves families in France and Germany and Italy as much as it does in the United States, Canada, and England. But it would be a mistake to think that the empire, which was based in Britain, simply went away after World War II. because this empire was based not primarily on colonies, but on trade, international trade, international finance, and also on having the most sophisticated and extensive intelligence system in the world. And as in this Century of War book, which I reference in the leaflet on the Afghanistan situation, and in places that we also have published, one of the key points with British intelligence is that they brought together both the heads of their major corporations with the military, the political system, and their actual intelligence system. That there was a blending of all of these, very much as the Venetian Empire of the Middle Ages had operated. Now, when you look at the world right now, you see crises erupting all over the place, from China with Tibet and the Uyghur population of, although this is not so much in the media, but one thing that we've picked up on, we put out a report a few weeks ago, is that you have an ethnic Muslim population living in Western China, which also spills across the border into the Central Asian republics, which is currently involved in funneling opium and heroin into China. The part of the population, because it's not all of them, but there's a certain element of extremists who want to set up their own Central Asian Islamic State. And this group has their global recruitment center in London, just like dozens of other terrorist groups around the world have their global recruitment centers in London, or as one commentator referred to it as Londonistan, the most important city in the Middle East. Now, so this group is being deployed against China, just as the opium wars of the 19th century were waged to force opium upon China. At the same time as Tibet is being used as the more overt means of destabilizing and provoking this country. Now, if you just have to look briefly into the history of the Dalai Lama to know that the Dalai Lama is no damn good. The guy is just a theocratic tyrant. You know, under his rule, the wheel probably still would not be in Tibet. Yeah. But that's something that can be discussed what this guy is about. But the point being that the whole Free Tibet movement was created by British intelligence, a guy named Hugh Richardson, in the years after World War II, as a way, again, to target China. You know, move west into Afghanistan. You know, the Brits right now control Helmand Province, producing over half of the total opium in Afghanistan. Canada is also a part of that. We've got Kandahar. It has the fastest rate of increase of opium production. So it's not really about peacekeeping. Look at Pakistan, the Bhutto assassination. Keep going west, right? Iran, Iraq, and so forth, down all the way to Zimbabwe. You have a hand at work here in targeting these nations, which is similar in all cases. We've reported extensively on this. Now, the question, though, that I'm sure everybody who begins to look into this is asking is why? Why would you try to set the world on fire? I mean, what are the implications of doing that? Is this something? Now, some people say, well, they're controlling it all. They know exactly what they're doing. That is, that this oligarchy that seems intent on creating some new global war. But in fact, that is not the case. These guys are as freaked out as anybody else that actually knows the extent of what's happening right now in the financial system. Because go back to dynamics for a second. If you look at the rate of increase of the money supply since July of 2007.
In physical dollars?
Well, no, not in physical money, but in, well, physical money plus the fantasy money that the central banks are emitting. Right? Most of it is electronic now. Like 95% of the money created is not created in the form of currency. But if you, from what we know of the emissions of the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada is also in that, but in a very much smaller way. If you look at that rate of increase of the pumping, it's now in the trillions of dollars. Now, some people, again, would say that we meet on the street that they're knowingly bringing down the U.S. dollar, right, the central banks. Actively doing it. They're doing it intentionally because they want to, either increase U.S. exports or competitiveness or something like that. But if you understand dynamics, you understand that the rate of increase of this emission of money is following a very specific curve that is defined, yes, right? On the back of the pamphlet here, you have it. That is defined not by the arbitrary will of the central bankers, but in fact by the breakdown of their own system. That is, when you have a speculative bubble, when you start that thing, you don't stop it. And at a certain point, this thing, they lost control of it. And Alan Greenspan himself, back in late December, admitted to that they lost control of the U.S. housing bubble. And that's when you started getting the subprime mortgages. And the loans got riskier and riskier. But these guys, knowing what they were doing, knew that they were caught. They themselves were trapped. Because if they stopped, if they stop emitting these riskier and riskier mortgages, the bubble bursts. So they have to keep going. It's like in Macbeth, when Macbeth's wife questions why he's about to murder his friend and general Banquo. And Macbeth says, well, to turn back now would be as painful as to go on. So these guys became, in a sense, the slaves of their own system. And this is what is now driving this monetary expansion. Okay, the printing of trillions of dollars. So that should give you a sense that these people were fools. They were always fools. They believed in something that never existed. You know, they believed in gambling. They didn't believe in a real economy. And this has doomed them. Now, an aspect of this which LaRouche pointed out recently in one of his papers, right? You know, why do we say that empires are always doomed, that every empire must collapse? Right? Because they're doomed by their own internal contradictions. The fact that you have to, an empire is based not upon the development of the human mind, right? It's based upon looting, raw materials, population, and so forth. We see that today with the cheap labor zones of the third world, right, as well as the destruction of the West, you know, our own economies. But now, the problem is, even though you need to have stupid people who you can control, that are very predictable, these stupid people must be able to do complicated things and make discoveries and do other things that can advance technology so that, for example, you can dig your petroleum wells, you can go deeper, right? Or you can do things more efficiently, because you don't, otherwise you're going to reach a certain point when the cost of extracting raw materials, as one example, gets so high that you can't do it anymore. And this itself will begin to collapse your productive process. And you do have to eat. And oligarchs do drive cars. And or helicopters or whatever.
The price of gold just went through. through the roof.
Speculation.
And now minds are being opened because it's worth the money to do the technology to get the gold. So, wow.
Right. So this is the kind of thing that you start to look at. So that poses a problem to them, right? Because with the kind of culture that we have today, and this is something that our youth movement has taken on, there is no scientific culture in the West in the sense of people having a general competence in scientific thinking. That's something that's been destroyed in particular since the baby boomer generation was itself targeted with the counterculture of the 1960s. And what this means when you bring it together is that the empire itself, as we understand, must cannibalize itself. Or you think of the Roman Empire, which expands and expands, but as soon as it reaches the point where it stops expanding, it begins collapsing upon itself. In 1971, LaRouche made a long-term forecast that with the changes that were being made at that point, with the destruction of the Bretton Woods system, and when the U.S. went off gold, that the process that had been unleashed would lead first to the looting of the economies of the West, and an increasingly rapacious looting, which would at a certain point force the looters to move overseas and loot other nations. He pointed to the communist economies as being a primary target. You know, the economies of Africa would continue to be looted and so forth. And you can find this debate. It's called the Abba Lerner debate, where he lays this out. And there's a certain eerie foreknowledge that he had just in the order in which he laid out in which the world would be looted. Because he understood the nature of the system and that this system would eventually arrive at the point at which fascism would be necessary to continue the looting. Because fascism was not simply a social phenomenon, but the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Italy were in fact installed as virtual tax collectors for the banking syndicates of Europe at the time. So this is the tragedy of the empire, that it itself cannot continue. And as LaRouche has said many times, well, if they try to do what they intend to do, this will bring civilization into a dark age. And that can seem extreme if you don't understand this issue of dynamics, or at least have an initial understanding of what he means, some insight into this. As in this graph, this triple curve graph on the back of the pamphlet indicates,
hyperbolic expansion
of the monetary system coupled with a hyperbolic collapse of the physical economy, which in this case means our capacity to support the human population. LaRouche often points back to the 14th century Dark Age as an example of how such a collapse can occur, which began with a banking collapse, which brought about or was the culmination of a physical economic collapse akin to what we have seen today, which create the conditions that when the Black Plague comes, people are crowded into the cities, there's no health care, there's all kinds of, this society itself is too weak to deal with the health crisis that hits. And as he says in this paper on the subject of strategic method, that this empire would rather die than give up being an empire. But that this empire also cannot win. they may believe, you know, these big, powerful oligarchs, that if they unleash the chaos that they're trying to unleash, maybe in a couple of generations, after things have, the dust has settled, they can perhaps come out on top. Perhaps. But what they do know for sure is if they simply give up power or allow nation states in this crisis to assert their natural inclination, which is to take measures to defend the people from famine, from the foreclosure crisis in the United States, and so forth, that they are doomed. Because if that process starts of a reorganization, of a mobilization of the powers of the sovereign nation state, this will lead to the dismantling of their cartels, of these trusts. And as well, one of the most important points is the end of this private central banking system, right, like the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and so forth. So they are willing to take that risk, but they can't win, but we can lose. And that's a point to be emphasized. We can win, they cannot win. They can only lose, but they can take us down with them. Now, if we don't want to see that happen, and I don't, and neither do my associates, and I'm sure none of you do either, then the question is, what can be done? Right? Now, LaRouche has laid out these steps. He does it in this speech on March 12th. He's also going to be giving a speech on May 7th, which we're going to screen here in Ottawa. Usually it's down at the Courtyard Marriott Hotel. But we can send you out the details when that's finalized.
Where is this Courtyard Marriott Hotel?
That's at Dalhousie and George? Is it?
All the
yeah.
One down at the market?
Yeah, yeah.
It's accessible through anyone's computer, though, as well, right?
It is, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So what is to be done? Well, you know, we've been organizing extensively in the United States recently around what's known as the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. We now have about 90 cities and 5 or more state legislatures which have endorsed this legislation. They've passed resolutions calling on the Congress to implement LaRouche's policy, and that is to freeze foreclosures immediately and indefinitely, and then take measures to protect the local and state banks, right, the legitimate banks where people have their savings, and let the big boys, let them go. But make sure that the vital systems of the economy continue to function. And then from there, you can, as Roosevelt understood and as he implemented his policies, you can begin a general reorganization of the economy at that point. But that's the first step. Now, more important, you could say, or directly important to Canada, is what he termed the Four Powers Initiative. Right? This is for the U.S. to approach Russia, China, and India, get these countries together, and settle a very, and this could happen very quickly. We are going to defend the value of the U.S. dollar, and to call for an international conference to establish a new monetary system. This is the point at which Canada comes to play a crucial role in organizing other nations to join this process. Now, we've been organizing leading circles in Russia for years, and LaRouche is very well known there. We're getting our material published. Actually, our material is being put up by Russians themselves on their websites. They're translating the material and everything. LaRouche's papers, our analysis of various hotspots in the Middle East and so forth. And what our work culminated in last year was a Russian proposal to Canada and the U.S. to build a tunnel across the Bering Strait and to link up Eurasia with the Americas by high-speed rail. Now, the implications of this, which Vladimir Putin knew very well, is to begin to break the control of the petroleum cartels. Right? Because if you combine high-speed electrified rail with nuclear power, the widespread development of nuclear power production, you break their hold over the world transportation system. But you also establish a precedent for a new relationship between Russia and the United States against this imperial system, which is right now moving to create a new war between these two countries. Also back in late November, early December, LaRouche got major press in China after he had attended, or he was a VIP at several U.S.-China summits in the United States, where he spoke on this Four Powers Initiative, spoke on the global financial crisis, and laid out his solutions. Since then also, in particular since the Tibet issue came up, LaRouche, well, on our website, and you should check this out when you get the chance, every week one of our top people named Jeffrey Steinberg gives a weekly briefing. We started putting out a video of this briefing instead of just an audio form. Now, one of our Chinese contacts went and put this up on YouTube, and in three parts. The first part, within a few days, had 50,000 hits. The next week, it was put up again, and within a couple days, it got over 20,000 hits on YouTube. Right. So this is the kind of, and much of this is coming from China, because they've recognized also who they're being targeted by, and that their strategic interest is in this alliance with the United States, a reformed United States, because obviously Bush and Cheney, you know, did not accept the Bering Strait Tunnel. Neither did Stephen Harper, right? And neither did the Canadian press, because they completely ignored it. But that project still stands. You know, that invitation to a reorientation of Western, you know, the U.S. Foreign policy is there. So we've been playing a key role in all of this. Now, in the end, though, what is really going to organize people is the future. You know, what is the future that is possible? And which is actually the true fear of this oligarchy. Well, a Russian scientist named Vladimir Vernadsky made certain discoveries, and this has also, over the last few years, played a significant part in much of LaRouche's writings, and also his the development of his economics. Vernadsky was called himself a biogeochemist. A biogeochemist. And what he was looking at was the interaction of non-living processes, living processes, and humans on the planet. And what he discovered, because he would look at something like a rock, and he wouldn't ask the question, well, what is the state of existence of this rock? But he'd ask, what process produced this rock? And approaching the planet from that perspective, what he discovered is that you have three different domains of action on the planet. You have what's known as the abiotic domain, that is, of non-living processes, you know, the core of the earth and so forth, and you get different expressions of this on the surface also, which produce certain fossils. You then have what he termed the biosphere, right, which is the domain of life. And what he found was that life itself is organizing matter in a fundamentally distinct way from non-life. That is, that you will find certain isotopes of iron, for example, which are only products of life. Water is only a product of life. And that life itself was increasing in its power over the abiotic domain. So So it was actually pound for pound a more powerful process taken as a whole than non-life. But what he also found is that humanity itself is expressing something also characteristically and fundamentally different from life alone. That we also organize the material universe in a way that life cannot do. This is what the environmentalists don't like. They say it's wrong, or it's bad of us to do so. But the biosphere produced us, at least in the sense of our material bodies. Because see, what human beings have is cognition. And we have the capacity to discover what we call universal physical principles. That is, you know, and one thing that our youth movement just finished doing was working through one of the original works of Johannes Kepler called The New Astronomy. Right? And he was the guy who discovered that the orbits were elliptical. But now, you know, when he discovers gravity, he doesn't discover a force or a formula. But as he himself refers to it, he refers to it as a species or a power, something immaterial which emanates from the sun and fills the whole universe. Yeah. And you can't see it, feel it, touch it, or anything else, and yet it has a certain power over physical bodies. Right, to move these bodies around the sun as the sun itself rotates. And LaRouche has furthered the understanding of the implications of this through his work in economics, and how when we discover these principles, right, because you never see gravity, and yet it must exist because it's affecting things.
You see its effect.
Right. You see its effect. Right. That by discovering these principles, which we can never do with our sense perception alone, we can create new technologies, discover new resources, and engage in the forms of behavior which increase our power in and over the universe. Right? And that this, now this is very interesting, because what it tells us is that the universe is not entropic. You know, the universe is not winding down like we learn in, you know, physics class in high school, right? That you know, we're moving towards heat death. You had the Big Bang and everything's kind of dispersing, right? But in fact, you have a universe, you have a planet that is dominated by abiotic processes, which does not produce life. But life as a principle, which fills the universe already, pulls the abiotic to the point that it can support life. And the biosphere itself is drawn towards the point at which a creature can be created, which is capable of expressing cognition. But that we're part of a developing process on this planet, which is a characteristic of the whole universe. And our actual purpose, and the purpose of humanity in coming generations, must be this. Right? To further this process of development, this process of creation, that is so natural. Think of a little child, or think of yourselves when you were children, and looking up at the stars, or playing with blocks, or just investigating the universe, you know, it's like every moment you're discovering something new, you know, and trying to figure out what's going on around you and make sense of everything that's happening. And yet in this society, that desire to know, that curiosity, is stifled. Now, the oligarchy may not exactly understand what they're stifling, but they know that they hate it. And they know that that's the true threat to their continued ability to exist. And in the end, what's going to inspire people to take on the challenge of dealing with this crisis, whether it's our members of parliament or the guy that you run into on the street, is this issue of the purpose of mankind's existence in this universe. So that's kind of what I wanted to say for now. If people have any thoughts or questions, we can open things up.
What do you think is going through the minds of the oil sheikhs and the Chinese and all others who hold massive quantities of U.S. paper, anything denominated in U.S. dollars, U.S. cash, it must be trillions of U.S. cash and all sorts of other derivatives and that. Chinese goods that have been sold here over the past decade or so, and from which they've accumulated all these dollars, will have become then, in effect, just a gift from China to the United States. That's what it will come to. So I don't think it's feasible for them to sell their dollars. Into what would they convert the dollars? In the price of whatever they put the dollars in, and they put them in gold would soon go to about $50,000 an ounce or something. They haven't been doing that for some reason. So will they just sit there forever holding all these worthless U.S. dollars with sort of the fantasy that they don't really get anything? What does Mr. LaRouche suggest that they should do? If Mr. LaRouche are running the Chinese finances now, what he suggests be done with these? It's about $1.5 trillion now U.S. dollars they've got.
Well, what you're pointing out here is it's the situation that the Chinese or the Japanese or any other country has that's holding U.S. dollars, but this is the case for the entire world financial system.
Well, all the central banks are.
And not just of U.S. dollars, but of all forms of speculative financial paper, of which the U.S. dollar itself, or the total U.S. dollars, are only a drop in a bucket.
Well, you're talking about shares now?
I'm talking about derivatives.
Well, derivatives, yeah, of course.
Right. I mean, a good example is J.P. Morgan. One single U.S. bank has on its books over $90 trillion of derivatives contracts, which are simply gambling bets on other forms of speculative paper.
Who got $90 trillion?
J.P. Morgan. One U.S. bank.
It's a big one.
It's a big one. But that's, you know, that is twice the size in dollar terms of the entire world economy. One financial institution. Now, nobody right now knows the total extent of the derivatives, the value of the derivatives in the world. Most likely, you would only value that in quadrillions. Right? I mean, another example of this is the oil speculation, right? That for every barrel of real oil, there's maybe 500 or 600 barrels of paper barrels of oil.
Oh, saying, well, we can produce this much. There is this much that's going to be able to come out of the ground or of this well or of this.
Yeah, that kind of, but also just more, I think, in the sense there of the buying and selling of this. Of, like, between the time a barrel of oil is put on a tanker in the Persian Gulf and to the time it gets to the refinery, it's bought, and so as soon as it's on the tanker, it goes on the spot market.
Oh.
Okay. because it's all, at that point it's already sold. Between the time it goes on the spot market to the time it arrives at the refinery, this is when you get 500-600 transactions taking place by these speculators on the International Petroleum Exchange in London. So, but, so this is the thing, you know, the mortgage-backed securities, this is the characteristic. Everything's frozen. The whole system is frozen, because that's the catch-22. You buy, or sorry, you sell the dollars, or you try to sell the mortgage-backed securities, and you devalue the dollar, or you devalue the mortgage-backed securities in selling them, because everybody knows they're worth crap. Nobody wants to buy them. So the only way you're going to sell them is by lowering your price. One of the other characteristics with the mortgage-backed securities is that by selling them, you set a market price for all mortgage-backed securities of that type. So you can't sell. But you also know that the longer you hold on to them, it's like a ticking time bomb.
But
so
they are, in fact, ultimately by some assets.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain things that are going on. And this is one of the reasons why we're seeing the speculation that's occurring in food now. Right, as one of the final resorts, the final areas of speculation that's available. Right, and you see how the speculation has moved from things that have less consequence to the physical economy, at least in the short term, to more and more obvious areas, right? Housing, energy, food, and so forth.
There's a trickle.
What are we going to do about it?
Well, LaRouche said, I mean, this is, it's one of the difficulties we have here, because Canada, most nations on the planet, are not in a position to begin the reorganization. This is why it is so important that we save the United States. You know, of what our organization, what Mr. LaRouche is doing in the United States. Russia and China are prepared to move. But unless the U.S. breaks with these people in London, it's not going to happen. It's an unfortunate situation to be in. There's plenty that needs to be done in Canada, but if we don't get the shift in the States, there's not much that Canada is going to do. You know, but on that note also, you know, Mr. LaRouche is in the process of completing a paper on the we're going to turn into a pamphlet on the U.S. elections, and he makes it clear at the beginning that his task, see, he's not endorsing any particular candidate, although currently he is favoring Clinton because at least Clinton is saying a few things, although they're insufficient, on the economic crisis. She's at least addressing the issues of the lower 80%, which indicates that with the right guidance, she could be a suitable president. But what he's focused on is the institution of the presidency itself, which is not just the president, but includes all kinds of individuals and institutions in Washington. It's actually greater than the president, him or herself. Now, his idea and the way that we need to approach this and the way our organization in the States will be in our organizing in the coming months is to shape the conditions within the society through this Homeowners and Bank Protection Act initiative, through exposing the this push for a war, you know, against China and Russia and so forth, to shape the conditions such that in November, a patriotic candidate can step forward. You know, LaRouche is saying there's a few things that are very important, right? Like, number one, that this is going to have to be a bipartisan presidency. So what we want to do is we want to get the same Democrats and the same Republicans, and there are a few, and get them together, the rest can take a hike. They can do whatever they want. But to govern the country on that basis of bipartisanship, where you're taking the best elements of the Congress, right, and the best elements of the rest of the nation, you know, as she crafts her cabinet, or he crafts her cabinet, you know, such that you can get enough competence involved to deal with the crisis. But what is absolutely clear is none of the current candidates by themselves are qualified to deal with what they're going to face when they get into office. So we have to look at it in that sense. How do we shape the policies of nations? The prime objective, or the prime initiative we need to take up in Canada, is the recruitment of young people to this process. That's absolutely imperative.
Say that again, young people?
Young people in Canada here, the biggest holdback for our work is having enough resources, enough people, in order to get in contact with enough of the population. I mean, I know all, you know, Pascal and JP and Sadluk, I mean, it's just, there's only 24 hours in the day. There's only 7 days in the week. And that's a problem.
What kind of a response did you get at Rideau Center today? Did very many people stop and talk to you and take your literature?
Yeah, I mean, we had pretty good responses both days. Again, it's more a problem of not having enough people to actually talk to everybody that would stop and hand something to all the people that would actually take something in the end. I mean, often, but we got out almost all the literature that we came with. You know, I don't know how many, like 1,400 leaf pamphlets and 2,000 leaflets and that kind of thing. So we got out quite a bit. We made probably 50, 60 contacts in total, and maybe 40.
It's a good response in the sense that people are triggered by something they don't understand, like
mm-hmm.
our attacks with gore, or you tell them, hey, you want to help us stop the world famine? They look at you, what world famine?
Mm-hmm.
So you get them to ponder about how the hell they didn't know about it.
Well, if people
right.
don't know about it, they must be off in the dream world.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
you know, there's
yeah.
the question of Arctic sovereignty and this SPP deal and
yeah.
The Martin case in Mexico, and there's the other young fella in Saudi Arabia in jail
mm-hmm.
about to lose his head because he was involved in some kind of a street fight. You know, things like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of problems that government is just dragging their feet on.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that the role we're trying to do in the street, one thing can be done because that's the idea of a concept driven. You're not able to address all these issues. What you have to get at is how can you have someone, a youth or whoever, whose mind will be to start looking at those things to get dirty in terms of knowing what's going on, in terms
mm-hmm.
of you trying to have a solution to problems. You know, sometimes people just have a sense of it. They say something is wrong in the Kingdom of Canada. Something fishy. I don't know what it is. But then you develop this sense of like a hunting dog, I guess. You
yeah.
really look into things. That's where the youth is important. The work on Plato, Shakespeare, and these talks. So we get these people to actually think about it. Giving a name, taking literature, and if you go at it like now, I'm going to be here twice a month, and hopefully things are going to start, going to have a lot more people and more response. But it was definitely a good 3-day organizing. You got to do it more and more,
mm-hmm.
adding the people.
You know, with 60, 70, 80 people doing what we're doing right now, from what we've seen in the U.S., we will be able to start taking over Canadian politics. That's for sure. You know, just in terms of, it's because there's so few major population centers, but between, you know, the work we're doing in Montreal and Ottawa here, You know, we get a local of, you know, we get a bunch of youth in Toronto and a bunch out west. And we're intersecting more than half the population. And at that point, you start, I mean, we already get out, I don't know how much literature in a year, tens of thousands of pieces of lit in Montreal and Toronto. You know, we did this trip out to Alberta last year to talk about this Bering Strait Tunnel project. And it really shocked Albertans to hear that a bunch of Montrealers drove, I don't know, like 55 hours to come talk to them about some tunnel under the Bering Strait. Right, but you would transcend that, the regionalism, and you get these people that really think about bigger ideas, and it was an awesome response we got from that. So we're doing that kind of thing. Again, we need to get more. The more people we have involved, it becomes an exponential process of growth as the ideas are spreading through the society. Key ideas, like right now, the fundamental issue at stake is whether or not the international relations will be governed by the recognition of national sovereignty or not, and the implications of that.
Well, if this SPP goes through,
mm-hmm.
we're going to lose our national sovereignty.
Yeah.
There isn't going to be a candidate anymore. But
no.
When I talked to Stephanie at Jury 100 number today, I got the very strong impression from her that there is quite a grassroots movement in the States.
Yeah. Well, look, 90 cities representing already millions of Americans have passed resolutions calling for the Congress to implement our legislation on this, the foreclosure crisis and the banking crisis. Five or six state legislatures have also passed resolutions, and this represents millions more.
Well,
you know, and we're building that around
the
country.
In the process of building this gigantic road now, right from Mexico, right up through the Midwestern states to Canada. And it's going to hurt a lot of people. It's also going to provide the drug runners and prostitutes and mafioso a nice big highway to do all their business.
Well, you know, before that highway gets finished, many things are going to happen. Now, we can stop that process. And I know, look, in the United States, what we're fighting for is to return to the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, who had this good neighbor policy, right, of the respect of another sovereignty. You know, but we got to fight it on that level. Because we got to keep in mind, obviously, what they're trying to do. Like in Europe, you have this project under the title of the Lisbon Treaty. 11 parliaments have now ratified out of 27. If all 27 members ratify this, the sovereignty of every nation in Europe will be wiped out.
This is the EU.
The EU would become a super state run by a bunch of EU commissioners, unelected, unaccountable. And the countries of Europe would become regions, administrative regions of this EU dictatorship.
In other words, no border?
No. No sovereignty for any nation.
I heard about that years ago. They want to make the North American continent a set of regions.
Right. Well, I mean, what we're talking about here in terms of the reintroduction of a principle, right? The kind of policies like the Eurasian Land Bridge or the Bering Strait Tunnel, these kinds of policies, what LaRouche has been doing in Russia. Look, we also, a big event happened maybe 2 weeks ago now. Italy elected a new government. The finance minister of the new government is a guy named Giulio Tremonti. He's been a long-time collaborator. He's like us, like that with us. He's very, very close. And he's openly calling for this new Bretton Woods conference. You know, that's one of his initiatives, is to organize for that, right, which is to establish a fixed exchange rate system internationally, right, and to take measures to begin breaking up the cartels.
Well,
right,
is it your main program, or at least maybe your ultimate or central program, is to change the monetary system of the world?
Well,
is that what
yeah,
it is?
That's one key component, yes. But the monetary system, we need to set that up to both protect nation states and allow for the physical economic development which is necessary, right? And also to break the power of these private central banks over the world's debt and money systems. Now, if we can do that, this North American Union thing fades into dust. So that's one thing. The fight to stop that is really going on in the United States right now. You know, even though LaRouche himself, as far as I know, doesn't directly address that issue, that's implicit in his writings on this question of the principle of Westphalia, the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, which to this day is the standard for international law. Right, that is that this treaty ended a whole, like a century and a half of religious warfare in Europe. Right, and what was recognized in the treaty is the necessity of promoting the advantage of the other. It is the other nation, the other signer to the signers of the treaty. Right, and that became the standard by which everything else was judged afterwards. You know, people like Kissinger and Blair are very clear that it's that system, by name, the Westphalian system, is what they want to dismantle. The issue now, to reestablish that as a concept-driven concept, but the reestablishment of that ends the threat of the North American Union, ends the threat of the Treaty of Lisbon, the Lisbon Treaty, or this greater European superstate, and so forth. Right. Well, the deadline is this year. They want to have it implemented for sure by the end of the year to have everything in place, so that in 2009 they can have the new system. However, even though 11 nations have signed it, one country has decided or has been forced to agree upon a referendum. Now, just like when the European Constitution was being voted upon a couple of years ago, I think in 2005, they tried to do this. So they took the European Constitution, just gave it a different name, added a few things in, like the death penalty, and called it, you know, and then started saying, well, since now it's a treaty, it's not officially a constitution, we don't have to have referenda. We just have to have the respective parliaments of the EU ratify this thing as a treaty, and that'll go smoother than having to, you know, you don't want to get the population involved, right? Because this is messy, and they have interests. The population has interests in there, so we don't want to worry about that. But in Ireland, there will be a referendum on June 12th, and from what we've been reporting on and what we've seen, the population is strongly against it. So either they're going to have to pull some schemes or whatever, but probably this thing is going to die in Ireland. It could die before that. You know, it only takes one country to not sign this thing, and it's off.
It goes against human nature. It could be a movie. They could take it. I mean, Canada is an example of what a success you can make out of multiculturalism.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think too many would be convinced. And that would be multiculturalism in spades if you try to do that with all these sort of much more nationalistic communities in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are traditional enemies. suppose. And this is shown up here very clearly in Canada. I mean, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, Trudeau was saying, well, okay, what we need here is what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought this is usher in some glorious new age of goodwill toward man and so on. But instead of that, trying to force people into a mold, it simply raises antagonisms. We're much worse off than we were before, it seems to me. And if they're trying to do the same thing in the EU, I think it'll end up, they might survive for a while, but then there'll be depressions and things that will get the people all worked up. And
mm-hmm.
They'll be blaming the system, and quite the same thing could happen in North America. If there's a major depression here, there'll be all sorts of popular resentment against what's happened, and it's not inconceivable they take some of the politicians out and hang to the nearest lampposts. It's such a horrible mess, and someone's going to get the blame for it. And the American sort of ordinary, the Joe Blow type of American, they've been sort of, they're really dumbed down. They don't even know what's going on. Things catch up to them, and it really hits them very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's bound to be some reaction. I think possibly some man on a white horse will come along, and maybe even a third party.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be so much discontent that they'll sweep the whole establishment out. But you were talking of sovereign nations and so on, but very few nations are actually sovereign. Canada is no longer
mm-hmm.
a sovereign nation. And even when we elect a government that's more or less workable, it very seldom represents the majority of even the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And Trudeau changed the whole landscape totally on the basis of what, 26% of the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
That's not sovereignty. This is a manipulation of some kind. But the politicians themselves don't represent their constituents. They represent the people who pay them.
Yeah.
This is a small lobby, small, very wealthy lobbies, they pay them. Well, of course,
mm-hmm.
that's who they represent. And if there's a conflict of interest between the lobbies and the nation,
mm-hmm.
it's resolved in favor of the lobby, always that way. And all the politicians know it. I speak from considerable experience, and I spent
mm-hmm.
quite a lot of time in senior positions in government here. And if you don't play the game, even as a senior bureaucrat, you're out. You've got to play the game, and the lobbies know this, and the lobbies have infiltrated all the properties of interest to them, and they know exactly what's going on, probably before the departmental staff themselves know. And they're in there, and they'll talk to the minister, and with regard to the most powerful lobby, which is the Israeli lobby, they used to have, I don't know if it's the same today, they would have somebody in the minister's office for foreign affairs, that's what they control it, almost virtually every day of the week, I mean every day, not once a month, but once a week, practically every day, and they would be instructing the minister as to how he should conduct Canadian foreign affairs. But of course, they weren't representing Canadian interests, representing the lobbyist interests, representing Israeli interests. So it's totally alien, and yet Canadians are so dumbed down. But this kind of thing is not publicized. Nobody even knows about it. And when Harper does something really stupid, which he does constantly, you know, it's not necessarily Harper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing what he's told to do, and
mm-hmm.
he better do it. Or he's out.
Yeah.
And even the most powerful politician in the world, or statesman in the world, you might say, who was elected with the largest popular vote in the history of the United States, when he made signs of abandoning Israel, they were very mild things, but Kissinger soon, the Secretary of State, of course, he was a closet Israeli, he got all the seized on some inconsequential episode of breaking at the Watergate Hotel. It would have been on page, the bottom of page 31. In the classified section, ordinarily, they took that and they built it up into a major, major issue, which it wasn't, of course, it was not inconsequential, to the point that Nixon, like I say, who was one of the most popularly supported presidents, rightly or wrongly, it only took them a matter of months before he was out of office, the most powerful man in the world at that time. They can do it to him, of course they can do it to you or me or Mr. LaRouche or anybody else. They have the power, they have the money, and they know how to use it. And they have the intelligence. How can you really realistically contemplate ousting these people who are the real center of power in the world?
Yeah, but that's why LaRouche started this youth movement, because you, or basically why he started his own movement in the 60s, because you realize that your major flaw in society, as I was talking about, you know, is it possible to have like one individual that actually doesn't feel too pressured by whatever lobby it is? Is there an individual that, can we develop individuals that will take some pressure, but say, oh, like shove the goat up,
and keep them clean,
right? He says, well, you know, we're human, so, I mean, a pressure is a pressure. You don't just say, I don't mind pressure, they can take all of them. Pressure is coming in different ways, so you have someone, you need someone that's very actually ready to get into this, this cage.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the more you get in that cage, the more the person is active in terms of challenging those actions. But at the same time, you get other people that start looking, hey, maybe I can get in that cage too, right? I'll let this guy lead the way, but I'm going to try to, you know, do a hit here and there. And that's what we see with the youth movement. That's why you have a force of about 250 youth in the U.S. that are passing this legislation. They know their history. They know where they are in history. They're not perfect, but as a group, they managed to get smaller people. Right? We have these, this HBPA legislation is a good example of a youth movement getting these other guys that are usually clueless, but they're getting all these calls by their constituents saying, I'm going to lose my health, blah, blah, blah. What are they going to do? And they don't know what to do. But we get there with the legislation. They jump in and say, we've got to do that. Right? It's still a process of education. We've got to realize that our population right now is suffering not just from the dumbed downness of the last hockey playoffs, but it's a longer process, right? People that were dumped for 40 years, we get youth that are never going to really get a chance to have it. You know, I remember when I was in the high school, you know, you don't study, you just do the exam and you pass because you get the trick. So you know, there's no stimuli. But when you get, so we have like 40 years of backwardness, but we should come very quickly. We can turn back on our feet. Because the problem is that, and that's especially with fact-driven or concept-driven, event-driven versus concept-driven. If you just look at the events, I mean, there are many reasons why you should just, you know, cut your veins and everything. So many bad events in history. But look at the events, and you say, oh my God, they get this war, this concentration camp. It's a never-ending process of naming a bunch of events. Although, despite those events, because we are here today, because there are certain things we know that were fought for. Think about some sort of unions in the past that fought, you know, for syndicates or whatnot, or universal health care, right, or education for all. These were fought for, despite bad events happening. And that's the whole idea of the LaRouche movement. When we go out, that's what we have to tell people, and how they can, despite those events, look at what human beings can really do. And then you go see a politician, and you don't want to profile him or tell him what he wants to hear. Mm. Right? You meet this Middle Eastern ambassador and say, I'm going to tell him all I know about the Middle East. Okay, well, you know, when are you guys going to talk about LaRouche? Are you going to start that's our approach, that's why it's working. Because you're gonna get people that will actually say, hey, Common Good, yeah, that's, I remember that in my class, but what is it exactly? And they work on these very tough ideas. That's how they can challenge the authority, like Felix Rahatan or whatnot.
It might take a revolution.
Well, that's what we're launching. Right? That's the idea. But, you know, these things also don't come in this society. I mean, especially with young people, they want stuff like that, right? You know, very real quick. You know, if the revolution is going to happen, they want to be able to microwave it or something.
It's got to be over before the hockey game starts.
Yeah, right. Or in between the periods.
I have to go now. Can I pick up some of your literature?
Absolutely.
I have a question. How does the euro play into all this? Is this something to help to devalue the U.S. dollar?
When it started, there was directly an attack on the national currencies of the nation. But it just became another expensive tool. So the value is high, but not because Europeans are in better shape. It's just high because true that when you have nations looking for reserves, you might say, well, screw the U.S. and let's try to have this new thing. And the problem is there's much speculation on the arms these days. So it's why you need a new system, right? The Chinese themselves, the Europeans themselves, the Indians, the Americans themselves.
Yeah,